Welcome. This is the podcast of Care Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager.
Welcome to today's episode of Care in Action, the podcast of Care Austria. My guest today is Dr. José Carlos Mariátegui, a distinguished scholar, curator, and researcher. Like always, a brief introduction of our guest. Dr. Mariátegui's work sits at the fascinating crossroads of art, science, technology, and society. He is the founder of Alta Tecnología Andina in Lima, an organization dedicated to exploring these intersections in Latin America. Dr. Mariátegui is currently a senior visiting research fellow at the London School of Economics in the Department of Media and Communications and a lecturer at Luis Guido Cali in Rome. With a rich background in media, archaeology, digital archives, and the impact of technology on memory institutions, Dr. Mariátegui brings decades of multidisciplinary research and curatorial expertise to the table. His curatorial projects have traveled the globe, from Sydney to Barcelona, engaging audiences with innovative exhibitions that blend art with cutting-edge science, including collaborations with CERN. His current research delves into the historical breakthroughs in cybernetics in Latin America and the transformative effects of digitalization on media organizations and memory institutions. And for all our appreciated listeners who are not sure what CERN is the European Organization for Nuclear Research. It's one of the world's largest and most respected centers for scientific research in particle physics, and it is located near Geneva in Switzerland. And José Carlos was the curator of a very famous exhibition there, and the name of the exhibition was Quantica Broken Symmetries, and it traveled all through many countries, and it was very famous.
I just want to add one thing to that. Please? That is very important. This was a co-curated exhibition with the director of art and CERN, my colleague, Monica Bello, who is in charge of the several residency projects, and as you already mentioned, it's a very successful program within CERN.
Mm-hmm. And I also had the pleasure to meet Monica Bello. And maybe she is also going to be one of our guests in the Care in Action podcast. So let's get started with our conversation. And to kick us off, really a very blunt question, what motivated, what inspired you to work at this famous intersection of art, technology, and science? What was it? What sparked it?
Well, first of all, Andrea, thanks for this invitation. I believe that my background, I was never a little bit happy with what I was studying. I studied first biology and then mathematics, but I was always interested in technology and also the humanities. And I think that what inspired me always has been this flow between practices. So breaking the silos, because the silos are just mental and institutional constructions. So, but human beings, we are able to move freely among disciplines. And by combining topics and practices, new ideas usually will emerge, which is actually what happened with cybernetics, which is the conceptual basis for artificial intelligence. And it's not a discipline, but it's a combination of different ideas, engineering, psychology, neurophysiology, even anthropology. So that was my idea. I was very young when I was in the university, and I had those ideas. But what happened is that I was able to put them in practice. I was very lucky to meet in 1995, when I was 20 years old, a very important media artist from Italy, Gianni Totti, whose 100th birthday is celebrated this year. He's sort of considered the father of video poetry, and he invited me to work with him on several projects for several years. And that's how I got involved with media art. I started to know lots of people in that community, which I now I now belong to that community. That's how I thought that we had to do something in Peru, where there was no movement around media art. So I founded a festival of video, video art and media art. And we organized the first media art commissions in the country, but also we did lots of exchanges. So we invited lots of people to Peru. We translated many works, even, for example, the work of Oliver Ressler. Oliver Ressler was in Peru, the respectable artist and activist from Vienna. And once more, we supported lots of local productions. And then we thought that Peru had a reduced visibility on media art in the region. And that happened also in other countries. So we started to work with other countries. So we did exhibitions. Well, we showcased the work of artists from other countries in Latin America, countries that usually are not visible, like Ecuador or Bolivia or Central America, just to name a few. And we organized several exhibitions. One was called Invisible Geographies, which toured around all Latin America and also in Spain. And that was co-curated by me and my co-founder of ATA, Jorge Villacorta. So that's how I started to curate media art. And meanwhile, I also studied a master's and a PhD in information systems under the guidance of Giannis Kalinikos, and my study was around the digital transformation at the BBC. But the BBC is not just a broadcaster. It's also a memory institution. Mm-hmm. And it's possibly one of the largest audiovisual memories of the world. And in that way, the BBC is also, in a way, a museum. No, so that turned a lot my attention into preservation, restoration of archives, and that's what I also been doing for quite some time.
And can I say that you are the pioneer? You were pioneering this in Peru? Because I'm not sure, I did not mention, you were born and grew up in Peru, right?
Yes, yes. I would not say that, because there were pioneers in the 70s when I wasn't born, or even in the 60s, but nobody cared to write that history. So I started to write that history. So I may be a person that puts in value, gives visibility to all these pioneers. I would not consider then myself a pioneer, but I consider myself a very curious person that tries to give visibility to a non-represented artists and communities in a way.
And you are already, we can jump right into our top topic of today, which is about memory institutions and restitution and all the varieties of it. You mentioned yourself that you gave visibility to artists and scientists and to countries that normally are not very visible in this arena. Why would you say is that the case?
Because always there is something that is called a mainstream. And the mainstream is not just, or the dominant institutions or the dominant countries. And that doesn't happen just in Europe or in the USA. It also happens in Latin America, where you have countries, huge creative machineries, or countries in Brazil, in Argentina, in Mexico, with huge budgets, great cultural infrastructure, very institutionalized programs, public and private. And that doesn't happen in other countries that are smaller, that are much more complex for many reasons. Or even in some of these dominant countries, there is visibility around the capitals or the main cities, but not necessarily around all the country. Of course, they are very large countries and big economies also. So I wanted to give visibility to those other ones, because I consider myself as a Peruvian, somebody that usually is not that visible. I mean, when you think about Latin America, you will think about Mexico, about Argentina, about Brazil once more. So one of the things that we did at ATA, at the organization that I started, was to create a lab, an innovation lab that was supported by the Spanish Cooperation Agency and the Prince Claus Fund, which was a civic and media educational lab of ATA. And we work on the relations between creativity, technology, and innovation on underrepresented zones of Latin America. So we were focused on the Andean and Central American region. nothing around Brazil or Argentina. So we tried also to make a point there that it was necessary to make an emphasis on those countries that were underrepresented. And we were very successful. We incubated the first Fab Lab in Latin America, supported by the MIT and once more the Spanish Cooperation Agency. And that little project, that spin-off, supported the development of more than 30 Fab Labs throughout the world. We did some of the first open data and hackathons initiatives in Latin America. Once more, those open data initiatives supported the idea of open data, especially in the public sector. So, I think we were, in that sense, we are very proud of what we did. And in that sense, yes, we did certain things before other ones. I would say that I'm very honored, for example, that we were featured in the National Research Council publication called Beyond Productivity as one of the only three significant international projects in art and technology. That was 20 years ago, that publication. But I mean, that meant that we were doing something different at that time. And we felt that we were obliged to defend the others, the ones that were not visible, even if in our region.
So you emphasized the relevance of the Andine region, let's put it like that. And as the leader of the largest NGO in Austria, I have to ask you, because this sort of education that is needed to be part of these topics, you need really a high level of education. Would you agree on that?
Yes.
Which is not so easily accessible for broader parts of the civil society, like in Peru, for instance.
Yeah,
right?
You're absolutely right.
And yes. Is your institution also opening up for those who don't have the privilege to tap into such sort of education? Is there an element of that?
Well, look, it's always very difficult to talk from the privileged side. And of course, I consider myself fortunate to have studied and had the freedom to study different things. Also, my parents enabled me to do that. I always felt that I had some responsibilities because of that. Mm-hmm. And that I had to do certain things. And I think that some of the things that we did, we had this lab in Lima's downtown, which is a very complex area. Extremely, I mean, it's a mix of all different societies in Lima. Mm-hmm. But not just that. We work a lot, for example, on a project on new media alphabetization and education using the one laptop per child project. Mm-hmm. Peru was a second country with more one laptop per child computers in the world, which basically was a standardized, was an idea from MIT, was a standardized out-of-the-box technology and disregards completely the polysemiotic nature that exists in some oral traditions in Peru. So what we did is several projects, not just in Lima, but also in other cities like Puno, where we try to use that computer to make evident that the problems were not to put the computer. The problem were the dynamics, the dominant dynamics, the ways in which they were looking at the implementation of technologies without thinking of the context. I mean, these childs were having a computer that was much more expensive than, even if we thought it was $100, it was more expensive than the wage of a month of their parents. So they were not able to take it, or there was no electricity. Lots of other issues that nobody thought of them. And we were not a big organization. We were not given any money for this. We did it because, and we organized several workshops with teachers and of course students, and that of course propagated. That's one of the initiatives. We also enabled perhaps initiative with the Fab Labs and with the hackathon. We might have initiated what I could define as small technocultural entrepreneurs in a way. We enabled that possibility to happen. But yeah, I mean, of course, it's always easy to talk from a more privileged position. That's absolutely true. But with that comes a lot of responsibility, I think.
That's true. And that applies, of course, to the two of us. And leading such an organization like CARE in Austria always also is an enormous privilege. And this privilege leads me to the fact that I had the privilege to be able to visit most of the countries that we are talking about, amongst them also a very interesting stay in Peru. And what you mentioned in your description, that children received a laptop and the laptop was much more than their parents earned per month in average, this is highlighting one of the big obstacles that large international organizations like CARE are somehow also struggling with. Because really, José Carlos, maybe you can answer my question. Who decides what sort of education is good enough, let's say, in a rural context in Peru? Because you are Peruan. Who decides that and what fits? And how can, because development is nothing linear, right? There are so many phases of development that happen at the same time. So who can decide when is the right time for a child in the countryside in Peru to receive a laptop? When will that be?
I think that it has a lot to do with the issue also around repatriation and objects. I think that governments, unfortunately, when we talk about this, it's obvious that it's a top-down approach and governments decide. They might have local or regional entities that, I mean, depending on the level of proficiency and capacity and also creativity and curiosity of the leaders, they may be more engaged with the communities. It's also very difficult to engage with some of these places where they are rural. I mean, you have to think, some of these schools are called, there are schools that are one teacher, multi years, mm-hmm. and it's just one room. Mm-hmm. And that means that, and some kids, they have to walk, I mean, 1 hour or 2 hours to get there. Yeah. So there are lots of issues. You may say that, yeah, the ideal thing will be that there is a bottom-up approach. That's not that easy. But once more, the thing is that we're dealing with objects and not with histories, with ideas, with cosmovisions, with things that are beyond the objects. It's not just to have the school. It's not just to have the machine. It's also to understand the different cultures and the dynamics and how that those dynamics are connected to the technology. Mm-hmm. So that those are things that I think that are lacking. I mean, of course, for that, you need to be more experimental. You may need to do some mm-hmm. experimental pilot projects. Mm-hmm. I know that now, for example, in Peru, they've been working on accustoming these schools to the different ecosystems, so mm-hmm. weathers and altitudes. So they have like 3-4 models of schools or even more. Mm-hmm. That's a recent development from the last 6-7 years ago. Before that, it was not the case. And the person that led that, the Minister of Education who led that, was a person that was very involved in culture, mm-hmm. And he understood that culture was first, and then the mm-hmm. the education, the pedagogical models, whatever you want to call mm-hmm. them.
I think that the pandemic boosted this approach in education systems globally, also out of the necessity to keep schools operating and going also in very remote areas. At least as CARE, we see that in many, many countries globally. But as you said, this is a development, I would say it started maybe a little bit before the pandemic hit us. And nowadays also we as a global aid organization, we also start talking about digital literacy. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know what you think, but in a very simplified way to express it, I would say that digital literacy will be the next big divide in a global civil society. Would you agree to that?
Yeah, I think that the thing is that we have to understand, and once more, this happens with technology. We cannot think of technology as just as a dominant perspective. we need to think that there are several types of looking at technology. So I think that, digital literacy should be understood as digital literacy. So there may be lots of digital literacies, mm-hmm. depending on, once more, on the cultures, on the understanding of technology of different groups, of social groups. So once more, the worrying thing here is that we are dealing with big interests, big platforms, people that own platforms like Elon Musk even, and they want to impose a specific way of looking at things, particular rationality. And this is a worrying thing. I think that's why, yes, digital alphabetization is fundamental, but in order to, once more, to think critically. And that is also connected to something that is very much ingrained into what we are talking about, which is the concept of coloniality, no, or decoloniality.
Mm-hmm. So it has to be culturally customized, to say it in a not scientific way.
Yes, it has to understand that there are other rationalities, not just one perspective about things. And I think this is very interesting because, when we talk about the concept of coloniality, which is connected also to reparations, I think, mm-hmm. which is the description of the ongoing colonial distribution, production, and reproduction of knowledge, mm-hmm. Which is sometimes maybe not that explicit when we talk about historical artifacts, but I mean, interestingly, the father of that concept is a late Peruvian sociologist, Aníbal Quijano. He's widely considered the foundational author of the colonial perspective. And what he stated is that coloniality implied this violent concentration of the world's resources under the control and for the benefit of a small minority, no? A small ruling class. And the issue is not just that, it's that there is a rationality in that way of thinking. And perhaps that also happens with museums, for example, particular, Euro-American museums, where there is a sort of universal model, and which in a way became the imaginary also for the non-European culture. That's how we've constructed our culture. But so the challenge is to think in a decolonial way, but in order to change this dominant legitimacy and to find that there could be other epistemologies, other ways of, other sorts of knowledge, and that we cannot think that there is only one, we cannot pretend that there is only one dominant perspective. And once more, this also happens in non-developed countries, not just in developed countries. I think that it's also important to mention that the looting of artifacts was not just done in non-European context, but also, I mean, the colonial domination during Napoleon time, which, I mean, looted several European collections for what is now called Louvre, until the Congress of Vienna in 1815, which ordered the restitutions of some mm-hmm. of those works. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting also to understand that the whole discussion about restitution is not just a contemporary discussion, but it's been already going on for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. And it was highlighted. And in German-speaking country context, it really had a big spike, the whole thing, after World War II until today. Most famous pictures we have to restitute. We have an own organization here in Vienna that is only dealing with art restitution from museums after the Nazi regime, which is something very important, and it will lead us also into the future, because only a handful of things have been restituted to Jewish families after World War II. So there are many aspects of looting art throughout human history. I agree with you, but unfortunately we don't have all the time in the world, and I want to focus a little bit with you now on these outer European artifacts.
I mean, I think there needs to be a huge discussion I mean, my own views on what the return of the artifacts to their countries of or cultures of origin is. Of course, it's good to bring them back. From the point of view of the former colonies, yeah, there is an expectation that local governments receive these artifacts. But honestly, those artifacts, taking them, I mean, in a larger perspective, and I'll put some examples, but they are just relics. It may generate, depending on the government, I mean, Mexico has a huge pride around their past. I mean, there are many pre-Columbian cultures in Mexico, particularly Maya and Aztecs. But I mean, like, there is a huge national pride, and there is a national identity around their past. But I would say that it is already problematic. I mean, there seems to be a focus on once more on the objects, but in the case of some of these artifacts, have they consulted with the tribal communities, the elders, the local populations from which the artifact originally belongs to, or where is the home of those return objects? Some groups may have disappeared, or they hide away because of violence. So, some groups definitely are not interested in the physical objects. And because the object is part of a larger story, it produces values, oral knowledge. And actually, in some countries, they might want some communities in some particular countries, they might want some sort of control or connection. But taking into account that in some countries in the world, there are repressive and authoritarian local governments, maybe it's better to be maintained or lent to a Western museum in exchange of other collaborations that actually will help them to develop a stronger civil society. So I think that it's not that easy. No, I mean it's not that easy. And once more, governments, I think that many governments, when they receive this, many of these museums or these countries, they don't have the infrastructure to deal with these objects in the sense that they would like to have them. And in some extreme cases, they try to adopt the ideas of Western museums, but in a non-Western context, which has a great impact on local culture. Mm-hmm. And it may even reveal racism, paternalism, exotism, which are the things that usually you are trying to reduce or to find a way with the restitution of neglecting those terrible stories that happened decades or hundreds of years ago.
And you are mentioning a very interesting aspect that I'm sure that many people who are dealing with restitution from an outer perspective or reading in the media about it are not so aware of, this, that many of these groups where the artifacts originated from live today in statewide concepts, where you can see at the borders how they are drawn until today. This was done in Berlin and Vienna at the congresses, that ethnic groups were divided in amongst two new states, for example. Yeah. And when we talk about Latin America, I studied in Brazil and I did my master about indigenous land rights. They are such a minority, the indigenous groups in Brazil, that it would be very difficult for any museum to restitute objects of daily life, for example, to the original ethnic group in Brazil, because you have of course people who didn't define themselves as indigenous, because you have certain, for example, land rights that you can claim then, but this would not necessarily lead to a useful restitution of art that was looted and taken away there. Colonialism started in 1500 in Brazil, so we have more than 500 years afterwards. So I think this is a very interesting aspect of the whole debate, to whom to restitute, because for a Western government, it sells very well to say we restitute artifacts to any other outer European government, right? This does not necessarily mean that the ethnic group of origin is part of the whole process.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, actually, there is something interesting, just as a historical detail. The first indigenous museum was founded in Rio de Janeiro by Darcy Ribeiro in the 60s. The first in the world. But today you would say, why in Rio? I mean, why not in the in the land? No, I mean, so there are already lots of discussions that one could bring to more contemporary problems. No, so yeah, I think that there is a James Clifford calls contact zones to these ideas of realizing a discussion which may deal to work with local communities to deepen the understanding of the objects before they are put actually also in public display.
Yeah.
And what is the experiential elements, including public programs, that the museums or memory institutions can do in relation to the artifact? So I think we have to understand that these artifacts, yes, were taken or stolen during colonial times, and it is not so easy to put them back into the hands of the people who made them meaningful, because these cultures, once more, they gone or they changed through the whole process of colonization. So returning the object doesn't change the problem.
No, not at all.
Yeah, but it can potentially also be a powerful way of opening up, and it should be like that, dialogues that have been muted, no?
At least this is happening. And for your question, why Rio de Janeiro for the first museum about indigenous art, hasn't it all had a lot to do also with our appetite for exotic showcases of the own country? And I mean, Brazil, I have lived there for more than 2 years. This is a continent, and indigenous groups are so far away, if you live in Rio de Janeiro or Sao Paulo, from your own imagination, that maybe this was also the appetite for exotic Brazilians to watch it.
Yeah. But actually, interestingly enough, Darcy Ribeiro, the founder of that museum, thought a lot about utopias. Mm-hmm. And this is why I think this is important, because, I mean, the discussion around the bringing the object back means it opens other questions. So are we reinforcing new forms of colonization, for example? Mm-hmm. So once again, we need to go back to the concept of coloniality and understand that it's a subtle process that ultimately excludes and obscures alternative forms of systems of knowledge. And the decolonial option means that we should there should be a way to open these types of knowledge, no?
Mm-hmm.
But why do you mention the idea of future? Because we cannot decolonize the past. We cannot decolonize that object.
We can influence the future, how we look at it in the future.
Exactly. So if we have to liberate ourselves from those colonial structures, we have to think of it as an effort for the future. You could even say it's, once more, as Darcy Ribeiro said, it's a sort of utopia. To think of utopia is not to think of an impossible goal, but it's a way of imagining, of dreaming of something that may never be attainable, but that is possible to continue to progress, to move forward. And I think that is something that definitely needs to be done.
So then I really hope that our conversation sparks this idea in many, many people. And it is so extremely interesting, but unfortunately, we can't go on in our discussion. José Carlos, thank you very much for your valuable insight, for your views. And CARE is extremely thankful that you were willing to produce this podcast with us. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. This was CARE in Action, the podcast of CARE Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For further information, go to care.at. Sponsored by CC Real.